Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your host, Monica Hadley, and our guest today is Christina Henry. Now, Christina is a horror and dark fantasy author who enjoys running long distances, reading anything she can get her hands on, and watching movies with samurai, zombies, and or subtitles in her spare time. She lives in Chicago with her husband and son, and the book that we're talking about today is The Place Where They Buried Your Heart. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Christina.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So does that, I'm wondering if you watch anime at all.
Oh yeah, I watch a lot of anime.
So my grandson has recently introduced me to anime, and the first one, because, you know, samurai, zombies, subtitles, got it all, right?
Yep.
And it's really interesting to me how gripping those stories are. The animation is in a way a little primitive compared to like Pixar or something like that, right? But they convey so much with just a single facial expression.
Mm-hmm. What anime has he got you watching?
The Titan. What was it? Something. Titan.
Okay. Attack on Titan.
Attack on Titan. Mm-hmm. And then now he's really into Bleach.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So I think those are like two of the really well known ones, possibly.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah. We went to Japan last year, and my husband, my son, and my nephew came with us, and we stopped in every One Piece store that we saw. So,
yes. And did you go to Anime Island?
We did not.
Yeah, I didn't either because it was raining, pouring down rain that day, and the big thing there was a zip line into Godzilla's mouth. So my grandson really, really wanted to do that. And so his dad took him, but I stayed back at the hotel for that one.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's really interesting. So which came first for you, writing horror or watching it?
So I would say, you know, when I was a kid, I read a lot of fantasy, but I watched a lot of horror because I'm a Gen X girl, and we used to go to video stores and rent horror movies.
Yes.
So, you know, I watched Nightmare on Elm Street when I was 10, totally appropriate, you know.
You know, I gotta admit, I am the mother of a Gen X girl, and she and her friends did the same thing. And I was like, how can you watch this stuff?
Mm-hmm.
But they loved it. They thought it was funny.
We used to go and rent all the, you know, rent a couple of movies. Usually you'd have to get someone's older sibling who could rent rated R movies, you know, to rent the videos for you. And we would, you know, it's like you all sit together and you scream. And then like later, you know, you play with a Ouija board, or like you do light as a feather, stiff as a board, all that kind of stuff. I mean, that was like sleepovers in the 80s.
Absolutely. Yes. And the other thing that my daughter pointed out to me recently was how really inappropriate the Flowers in the Attic books were.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh. And we all read them. We all read them.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, we were like 11, 12, 13, we were all passing those paperbacks around. Totally.
And here's the funny thing. I never read any of them. I knew she had them. I was just encouraging her to read, right? I didn't know what was in them. And for those who are listening and may not know, it's not just horror. It's incest.
It's about incest.
And, yeah. So, I had saved all those books for her in case she ever wanted, you know, them to give them to somebody else. And when I mentioned that, she's like, Mom, do you know what those books are about?
I know, it's crazy, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I do think part of that too is kind of the Gen X experience, right? Nobody was like monitoring us super closely.
Right, exactly.
Just kind of consuming whatever we came across.
Yeah, and that's true. I'm a more in the boomer category, and that was true for us too. Nobody was really in the younger boomers, the later boomers. Nobody was paying any attention when at all. And things have certainly changed. But however, obviously, people are still loving horror and dark fantasy. Why do you focus on those genres? Because I think I would find it kind of scary to write. Mm.
I think that it's just a place where my brain goes to. So when I was young, I read a lot of fantasy, and like I kind of scooted sideways into reading horror from fantasy, which wasn't, I think, uncommon at the time, because stores didn't used to even have horror sections. Usually they just shelved the horror books in the fantasy section, if they had any kind of supernatural element. So I always read fantasy, read horror. And then when I started writing, it just seemed a natural place for me to go. That was just where my brain went. My brain doesn't write romantic comedies. I like to read them, but my brain doesn't go there when I want to write.
Okay, so did you always know you wanted to write?
Yeah, from the time I was 12, I wanted to be a writer. I read The Lord of the Rings, and I remember loving the book so much. And I asked my dad for a notebook so that I could write a book. And, I think I wrote maybe 70 pages of something. And I decided then and there that I wanted to be a writer. I mean, I was always a reader. I was one of those kids who I don't remember not reading. You know, I was like in first grade reading like fourth, fifth grade level stuff. I was always like ahead of the curve because I was always a reader. So it just seemed natural for me to become a writer.
You know, my mother was just telling me the story. She's told me before, but how when I started kindergarten, I was four when I started kindergarten, that the teacher called her up and said, "I think you got her age wrong because she already is reading."
Yeah.
But that's because my older brother was. So I would learn, I was just doing everything that he did. And so I learned to read even before I started kindergarten. And like you, I always had a book.
Mm-hmm.
No matter where.
Yeah. And I'm still like that. I get nervous if I go out somewhere and I might, be on a bus or in a waiting room without a book.
You might have 5 minutes and you don't have something to read.
You could read something.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, I saw this ad of a book purse for men that just like a shoulder bag that they could put their book in so that a guy who like us who wants to, because we have our purses, we can do that. But what do guys do? You know, unless it's,
And
of course, that's what paperbacks originally were, pocket size, right?
Yeah, but that was back in the day when like paper was cheaper to produce, and there's a whole discussion about this now because a lot of people are kind of mourning the days of the mass market paperback, which was the smaller format paperback, which doesn't exist anymore. And part of that is because the cost of paper and printing costs have gone up so much, it doesn't make sense for publishers to produce them. So they default to the trade paperback, which is the larger size paperback that you usually see in the bookstore now. And ebooks have replaced the mass market.
Right. So where do you fall on the ebook versus hardcover book? And I'm, you know, for those of you who are listening to this, you're not seeing what I'm seeing, which is a bookshelf full of actual books behind Christina.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a giveaway that I'm not really an e-reading type of person. I tried to use an e-reader early on. Someone gave me a Nook in the early days, and I didn't like it. Because part of reading is that tactile experience of holding the book, of smelling the book, smelling the print, or if it's an older book, smelling like that old book smell, the feeling of the book in my hands. And also, I like to see how much progress I've made. Like that percentage thing on the bottom does
Doesn't
not
do
work
it.
for me.
I understand that. Now, I do a lot of my reading on ebooks because, I'm getting books sent to me, and not all of which I'm going to keep or read. And so I feel just for my carbon footprint that doing it digitally is better, not just for the paper and the cost of the paper and that, but also the transportation. So, yeah. So I kind of end up doing a lot, but I got to admit, if I have the ebook and I have the physical book, I'd rather read the physical book.
I always wanted, that scene in Beauty and the Beast, Disney's Beauty and the Beast, when he gives her the library, like that's like my dream guy right there, like
Oh,
the guy who gives you
absolutely, absolutely.
the
Yeah. And on social media, I've seen these pictures of these amazing libraries around the world, and it's like, all right, someday I'm going to do a trip just focused on visiting libraries, right? Yeah.
And bookstores, I mean, like if I
Well,
see a bookstore, I
yes.
gotta go into it.
Yes.
I
Yeah.
have
So where's
to.
your favorite bookstore?
So my local is Three Avenues Bookshop in Chicago. They're owned by a husband and wife team, Tim and Jordan, and it's just a lovely little shop. Chicago has a really thriving independent bookstore scene. There's a lot of bookstores here. There's a four independent bookstores within like a mile and a half
Oh,
walk of my
wow.
house.
Oh,
So just
wow.
go in any direction and you'll find a bookstore. And we have a great public library system here too. The Chicago Public Library system is excellent.
Yes. And I like to put in a plug for bookshop.org.
Yes, which supports your local
Yes.
bookstore.
Yeah. So you can order online. You can get ebooks through there too, and it supports your local bookstore. And also, if you go to it through my Writer's Voice Society, it supports Writer's Voices too. So,
Okay.
yeah. Okay, so Christina, where they buried your heart. Tell me a little bit about this book and where the idea for it came from.
So, the book is about the book starts off with a girl named Jessie who's 13 at the beginning of the book, and she is at home, she is grounded, and her brother comes into her room to try to cheer her up. And she's 13 and she's in a bad mood. She doesn't want to deal with him. So she tries to needle him until he leaves, and she dares him to go into the abandoned house down the block, which he does with his two friends. And the house eats her brother, not in a metaphorical sense. I originally conceived the story. So all of my books come from an image that I see in my head, or maybe like a line of dialogue that I might hear. And for this book, I saw three boys go into a house. I saw two come out. One of them was missing an arm, and I needed to know who they were. So, like a totally normal person, I wrote a book so I could find out the answer.
All right. And when you start writing, then you don't know what the ending's going to be.
No, I like to just start the book and see where it goes. And I'm not, my books end up having plots, but I'm not thinking about the plot as I'm writing. I'm thinking about the characters. And so a lot of what happens derives from the character's choices and things that they do in the book. And in the case of this book, the house itself has its own motivations. It is itself a character. So that, of course, affects the way the plot turns out. But I like to discover the book the way a reader would discover it. I'm usually maybe I'm like 5 or 10 seconds ahead of where I'm actually writing
Oh,
when I'm
wow.
writing.
Okay. So, do you surprise yourself?
Oh, yeah, all the time. a lot of times if you're surprised, I was surprised. I'm like, oh, I didn't know that was going to happen. That's pretty cool. It's just that I really try to do what I think of as like, I leave it in the back of my brain. I don't like pull the story forward to the front of my brain and say, this is the next thing that needs to happen. This is the next thing that needs to happen. I just sort of leave it in the back, kind of on simmer, and it's there when I need it.
Okay, so this is set in a Chicago area neighborhood.
It's in
It's
Chicago,
in
yep.
Chicago. And so is it a specific neighborhood that you're familiar with?
Yeah, it's my neighborhood. This is the
Okay.
first book I've written that's in my neighborhood, which is Wrigleyville. I've written 19 books, and 8, 9, 10, like 10 and a half ish have been set in Chicago. But this is the first one that's like really in my neighborhood, which is Wrigleyville, which is the area around Wrigley Field.
Okay.
Yeah.
And did you, how long have you lived in that area?
21 years.
Okay, so the
Yeah.
book starts in what year? I mean, there's some historical back, there's some flashbacks to earlier times anyway,
Right,
but
right. It actually starts in 93,
in 93.
1993.
Okay, so
Yeah.
then that was would have been a little before you were there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you feel like the way you remembered the neighborhood when you first moved there is pretty much the way it was in 1993, because it
Yeah,
changes a
I mean,
lot during the time period of the
yeah.
book. Yeah.
Yeah, it's changed a lot like while I've been
Yeah,
here.
yeah.
But yeah, I mean, there's certain landmarks that I use sort of as fixtures. I don't describe like every single thing in the neighborhood, you know? So yeah, you can just sort of like fix on certain things to be like, these are the markers of the neighborhood. But one of the things that hasn't really changed too much, or at least the facades of a lot of the buildings, which is something that I talk about in the book, that where I live, there are a lot of Chicago graystones, which are two flats, usually sometimes three flats, which were meant to be multifamily homes, and they have a very specific look. So they're faced with graystone. They're like these big gray blocks. If you've never seen them, you should go look up Chicago graystone. And they have what's called the Chicago entry, which means that the porch is elevated above the street level, and the bottom floor is like kind of peaks up a little bit from the ground. Like the basement level isn't level with the street level. Like the ceiling of the basement level isn't level with street level. And that's because Chicago used to sink. We literally used to sink. So when it was built on swampland, and there's actually a whole historical event that happened early in Chicago's history where they raised the buildings downtown because they had sunk into the swamp. So they used to build these high porches, sort of buffering against the possibility that the building might sink.
Oh, wow. And they're not sinking anymore?
No. It's been a long time since they sank, but it's become kind of an architectural feature of
Okay.
Chicago buildings. Yeah.
Okay.
And then there's other neighborhoods that have other kinds of buildings in it, like the Chicago Bungalow, which is quite famous also. And I think that one of the things that's interesting about Chicago is you can go to certain neighborhoods and you see certain types of architecture that are sort of characteristic of that area.
And the fact that the houses weren't primarily wooden in.
Oh no, that was actually illegal actually after the fire. We had this big fire, you might have heard of it, the Great
Yeah.
Chicago Fire.
Yeah.
The whole city burned down, and actually it was illegal to build with flammable building materials. So most of the immediate like post-fire buildings, and then for many years after, were all built with brick or graystone or some combination thereof, because you could not build with flammable materials. There were no wooden houses.
Now, has that changed?
I don't know that. I mean, I don't know that there's still a law. There may still be a law. I'm not aware of that. But people don't tend to build with wood here. And even if they build new construction, A lot of times they build on an existing facade, which actually is something I talk about in the book as well. They take the kind of the existing facade of the book, and then they might, you know, break down the back of the house and then rebuild that with brick, but they'll still keep the initial the facade. But even newer constructions tend to be brick.
So in Where They Buried Your Heart, there's this house where these boys were injured and one disappeared. You would think that there'd be an immediate call to tear down the house. But no.
Yeah, no. Because the house, one of the things that I do in the book is I talk about how the house kind of exerts its will on people around it. And I don't say it explicitly, but I think it's implied that the house is kind of stopping anything from happening. It wants to continue to exist.
Yeah. And eventually it does literally stop.
Yeah.
The bulldozers from.
Yes. Yeah. Later. Yeah.
Yeah.
But then it's only a temporary attempt to try to do something about it.
Yeah. Yeah. So do you think, like, when a tragedy like that happens, and of course people aren't blaming, they aren't saying that the house ate the, they're not believing that the house ate
right.
this child, and or that the other things that terrible things that happened there are the house's fault. They assume that there's some human behind it, and yet even then it's like, you'd think there'd be more reaction, more response to it, but that's because mm-hmm. of the house's exerting
yeah.
its will. Okay. All right. That
yeah.
that makes sense. And people do forget.
Yes. And I think that part of the thing that I talk about in the book is like a bad thing happens, and then there's some people who remember and who, like in the case, there's sort of an inciting incident, which is the reason why the house is abandoned, you know, from about
right.
20 years before. And people who still live in the neighborhood remember that event, but only a few of them remember it really as it was. A lot of them, it's almost like an urban legend, you know, like something bad happened there once.
Yeah.
And that's what happens actually later in the book after the main character's brother is eaten by the house. A few years later, there are some teenagers who get kind of a garbled version of what happened. And to them, it's just a story. And so they go to the house, you know. So, and I think that happens. I think that things become garbled in the telling and they don't seem real. And, you know, people come and go from a neighborhood and not everybody remembers. And yeah, stuff just kind of fades away or gets mixed up or becomes something else entirely.
So as you're, you know, there were parts of this that I did find pretty kind of horrifying.
Mm-hmm.
Scary.
I hope
and I'm like, and I'm you know, reading it at night alone. I'm like, should I be doing this? Am I going to get nightmares? Do you give yourself nightmares?
I don't. I mean, it's funny because I've been asked this a lot, and I think it's because when I'm writing the book, like I'm in the moment with the book, and it's happening while I'm writing it. But then it's over. You know what I mean? I put the manuscript away and I'm not thinking about it for the rest of the day. I'm not dwelling on it, I guess.
Okay. So you
yeah.
can really separate it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm in the moment when I'm writing, but when I'm not writing it, I'm not, like I said, I kind of keep everything on the back burner. I'm not kind of walking around thinking about plot points or things that might happen next.
So do people who know you and know that you write these books, like, kind of sometimes think, what's wrong with you?
No. Anyone who knows me already knows I'm demented. So, you know, anyone who actually knows me is not surprised. I think that other people might
I mean,
be
you
surprised.
Look like a very nice, normal mom, you know?
I only appear that way. Yeah.
So, how old is your son?
He's 19 now.
Okay. Yeah. So he's read your books?
He's read a couple of them. For a long time, I didn't let him read them. Now he's really at an age where he could read them. He's at engineering school, so he doesn't have time to read them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did he read horror as a young person? You know, YA horror?
Yeah, he read some. He read, but like me, he read a lot of fantasy. He really, you know, is a fantasy fan.
So where's the line between, or is there a line between horror and fantasy? I mean, because I guess dark fantasy certainly has some elements of horror in it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of, you know, like a spectrum rather than like a hard line, you know,
yeah.
It's like... There's certain kinds of fantasy, right, that are very light, and then it starts to, you know, you start to go across the spectrum and it starts to get a little darker, and then like at some point it will veer into horror. And there's ranges of horror too, because you can go from something that's just atmospheric, like gothic horror, to something that's very explicit, like splatterpunk horror. So like even within horror, there's a lot of range of what horror can be.
Now, does horror always have a supernatural element, or is it not necessarily?
Yeah, not always. I think it can be a defining element of horror, but I think horror ultimately is about emotions, you know, and I think that the point and purpose of horror is to raise and or confront emotions. A lot of horror is about trauma, dealing with trauma, confronting your fears, or, I mean, this might sound crazy, but I think the place where they buried your heart isn't about a monster house. I think it's about love. You know, I think it's about the love that we can find. I think it's about the love of a parent for her child. I think it's about the love that Jesse's mother didn't have for her. I think, you know, that all, and it's also about people in the neighborhood who become kind of her found family, and that it's about people who love each other and who are trying to protect that love from a monster. I don't think it's necessarily about the house.
Yeah.
The house is just a vehicle for emotion.
That, I think that's very well said. And I think that must be kind of the answer to why people are drawn to reading horror, is because it is about emotion.
And I think it does help people. I mean, you can process your emotions in a safe place. You know, the danger isn't really there with you.
Right, right. Well, why don't you read a little bit from Where They Buried Your Heart?
I have to change my glasses. To my other
I do the same thing.
Okay. Chapter 1, 1993. I was at home, grounded for stealing cigarettes from Johnny's corner store on the day my baby brother Paul was eaten by the house at the end of the street. Paul was 8 and I was 13. I wasn't there when it happened, but it was my fault anyway. The house, the old McIntyre place, had been abandoned for 20 years when Paul and his friends Richie and Jake snuck in through the back door. They weren't supposed to get hurt, none of them. It was only a dare, a childish thing. I couldn't have known what would happen. Neighborhood teenagers had used a certain broken window on the side for years, had smoked and drank and gotten inside each other's pants in the dusty, rat-infested living room of the former residence. Those kids always said the place was creepy, that there were bloodstains on the walls. Some of them claimed to have heard noises upstairs, but this kind of talk was mostly dismissed. There was always someone in every group, usually a boy, who wanted to terrorize the girls into squeezing closer, and saying there were noises upstairs was an easy way to do that. Nobody ever said the house was dangerous. That is, beyond the obvious fact that it was an old, rotting house. More than one kid needed an extra tetanus shot after going in there, but nobody died. Nobody died until Paul. I should probably say that nobody died because of the thing in the house. because somebody had died there, that's for sure. Seven somebodies died there, and they died in such horrible ways that no one had wanted to live in the house ever again, which was why it was abandoned and rotting, which was why it had become the perfect place for the kids in the neighborhood to have a little thrill of danger without actually experiencing it. Except for Paul and Richie and Jake. Three went in and two came out, and it was my fault. It was a rambling three-story frame house, unusual in an area that had mostly two or three flats made of brick or graystone, canted a little to one side like there was subsidence beneath. Chicago was built on a swamp, so the subsidence kind of made sense, except none of the other houses in the neighborhood tilted that way. As far as I knew, no one ever went up to the third floor. Most kids don't even like to go into their own attics, never mind the attic of a building that had holes in the stairs. One time, Scott Gunther tried to go up those stairs on a dare, and his leg went through the third step. His pant leg tore all the way up to the hem of his briefs, and he was pretty embarrassed about that when they yanked him out. The two other boys who dared him were laughing until Scott's eyes rolled up into his head and he collapsed. That was when they realized the broken wood in the step had carved a deep, jagged line in Scott's flesh from his ankle to his thigh, and he was bleeding out while they laughed. Scott was a few years older than me, and he never wore shorts again because the little kids would ask him about the scar. The neighbors across the street, the Rileys, said they heard Paul and Richie and Jake screaming sometime around 3:30 p.m. Mr. Riley was watering the front lawn and listening to the Cubs game on the radio. Mrs. Riley was clipping coupons from the weekly circular at her kitchen table. The window above the sink was open. She told me later that she heard the three boys over the sound of the game and the traffic on the street, even though the kitchen was in the back of the house, like most Chicago apartments. There was an ear-splitting scream, high-pitched and terrified, and Mr. Riley shut off the hose. Mrs. Riley stood up from the kitchen table, her scissors still in her right hand, and went to the front of the house and opened the door. "Carl, did you hear that?" she called, and she told me her heart felt like it was about to burst right out of her throat, the sheer unnaturalness of the sound spiking panic through her. Carl stood on the lawn, the hose sprayer in his hand, his head cocked to one side. Mrs. Riley remembered the crack of the bat, followed by Ron Santo's voice lamenting a Cardinals run. "And then," she said, "it was pure pandemonium." The boys were yelling and crying loud enough to be heard all up and down the block. Mrs. Riley rushed out the front lawn, wielding the scissors. Mr. Riley dropped the hose and ran across the street, pushing open the rusting metal gate. Mrs. Riley said that she stood there, holding the scissors and not knowing what to do. The Majewskis came onto their porch, holding hands, their faces terrified. They lived to the right of the Rileys on the first floor, and they were both in their 70s. Mrs. Majewski was so pale, Mrs. Riley was worried she might faint on the spot. She wore a pink-flowered housecoat and her carpet slippers, and her hair was white and fine and fluttering in the breeze. Mrs. Riley thought she looked like a dandelion with a bent stem. Ted Zabrowski, who lived on the other side of the Rileys, rushed out his front door. He was in his mid-30s, divorced, and had one 15-year-old son, Alex, who was known as a problem child, around the block. Ted wore his Sandberg jersey, and he held a can of Old Style. "What the hell, Sheila?" he said, staring across the street at Carl, who was trying to open the front door of the McIntyre place. There were boards tacked over the frame to keep anyone from going inside. The boards were covered in faded citations that had, as far as anyone knew, never been followed through on. Maybe if the city had done what they were supposed to do and torn down the property years before, none of this would ever have ever happened. Ted dropped his beer on the lawn and ran to help Carl. "Should we call the police?" Alice Majewski said, her voice quavering. The screams were louder, more frantic, and mixed with the hoarse cries of Carl and Ted Dabrowski calling, "Hang on, kids, we're coming!" and the crack of the bat and the cheers coming from the radio. Sheila Riley said the men got the boards off, and Ted Dabrowski ran at the door like a linebacker, shoulders first and legs low, and the door flew open as if by magic. "And then," Sheila Riley told me 10 years later, after Carl Riley had died from stomach cancer and Ted Dabrowski's problem child had become my personal problem, "it was even worse. Because the door was open and there was nothing to muffle that sound, the sound of those boys in terror. Carl and Ted just stood there in the doorway, and you could tell they didn't know what to do. There was this other noise then, this almost roar, but it wasn't exactly that. I don't know how to describe it, except it was like there was a crack in the world. And right before that crack closed up again, I heard him. I heard Paul screaming your name, saying, "Jesse, Jesse," over and over again.
And that's Christina Henry reading from Where They Buried Your Heart. So you said this is your 19th book.
Yes, it is.
And when did you start publishing? How long ago?
My first book came out in 2010.
Okay, so
yeah,
that's more than one book a year.
Yeah, it is. So for a while, my publisher wanted like one every 6 months, and then I said that pace was not good for me.
Is writing your full-time job?
Yeah, it is.
And has it been since 2010?
Yeah, it has. I've been with the same publisher for 15 years, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah. How did you get started? Had you been writing for a while before that?
Yeah, I was writing, and then when my son was two, I kind of decided I had something I was picking at. I had maybe three chapters of it, and I was like, I need to stop this nonsense and just write the book. And then I sat down and I wrote. It took me like maybe 7 or 8 weeks, and I just wrote the rest of the book very determinedly, with the intention of sending out the manuscript when I was finished, because you can't send something that you haven't completed, right? You know? And I had always wanted to be a writer, and I was like, if I want to do this, I just have to do it. So when I put him down for a nap, I would come out and try to write as much as I could. And if you have kids, you know that sometimes they sleep a half an hour and sometimes they sleep for 3 hours. And whatever I could get done, I would get done. And then when he got up, I would stop writing until the next day.
Okay. And what was that first book?
That was Black Wings. That was an urban fantasy about Madeline Black. She's an agent of death, and she has a little pocket gargoyle who's like her guardian named Beazle. And it was maybe about 75,000 words, so a little shorter than most of the books that I write now, but that was sort of common for that type of book at that time. And Ace/Rock/Berkeley, which is the publisher I'm still with, which is under the Penguin Random House umbrella, they at the time had a direct submission policy, which meant that you could submit to what was informally known as the slush pile if you didn't have an agent. And 2 weeks after I submitted to the slush pile, I got a 3-book contract.
Wow. So
yeah.
So some people might consider that an overnight success.
I tend to think of it as lucky. I think right place, right time. You know, it was, I think it was a good book. I think it was a publishable book, and I always thought that. But maybe if a different editor had been reading the slush pile that day, like, who knows, you know?
So you got in without an agent. Is that possible today?
I don't know that it's as common. Berkeley has occasionally opened for direct submissions. I think last year they had a brief period where they were open for direct submissions, but I think most publishers now don't have a direct submission system. They only take agented work.
Now, do you have an agent now?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. So why did you decide to get an agent once you were already in the door?
Because an agent knows this better than you do, honestly. They can negotiate a better deal for you. I did pretty good on my first negotiation by myself, but I could have done better if I had an agent.
All right. And have you stuck with the same agent throughout
your
career?
Yeah, the same agent.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you ever pitch to other publishers, or you're just really happy with the one you have and wouldn't ever, or aren't, you know, don't consider going elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, the ideal is that you come to a publisher and they want to nurture your career, you know, that they want to grow you as an author and that they understand, like, some books will do great and some books might not do as well, but that's okay. Like, you're kind of looking at an overall pattern of success, hopefully. Mm-hmm. And I think if you stay with the same publisher, they become invested in you as an author because they carry your backlist. So I think it's good if you can find a situation like that and stay with it. I think it's tough now because I don't know that as many publishers go into buying debuts with the same attitude of we're looking to acquire this person long term.
Mm. How has the publishing industry changed in the 15 years you've been publishing?
I mean, there's a lot more consolidation, but also there's a ton more books on the market, and that's not, and I'm not even talking about independent authors, like people who publish themselves. They think there's roughly 2 million books that come out every year from indie authors. Wow. So, but even if you just look at what publishing, traditional publishing is doing, they put many, many, many more books on the market now than they used to. I think maybe roughly 500,000 a year. So you're looking at like a lot of books that are coming out, and all the books are sort of fighting for time and space and readers' attention.
Yeah. So how have you been able to maintain that, the readers' attention?
I mean, it can be challenging for sure, in a crowded market. And also, it does help if you are established and the people have been following you for a long time. I'm not sure how difficult it is now for, you know, for writers just starting out. I think it really depends on how much support they get from their publishers in terms of, you know, marketing and publicity and stuff like that, because there's only so much an individual author can do for themselves.
Right, right. So do you do a lot of interviews like this?
I do a fair amount. Yeah. I think I spent the entire month of October before the book came out.
I bet. I'm looking at the pitch that I got from you, and it said this was your first ever hardcover.
Mm-hmm.
So why did the publishers decide to bring this out as a hardcover book?
So there's a lot of horror on the market now. Some trade publications won't review unless it's in hardcover, so that's part of it. And you are kind of fighting for every, you know, opportunity to get the word out. In terms of visibility, Barnes & Noble continues to be the single largest buyer of books in the country. And Barnes & Noble has basically gone to, if you go into the front of a Barnes & Noble now, you'll basically see hardcovers. So it was a visibility issue. Also, if it comes in hardcover, you have a second chance again later when the paperback comes out too.
Right. Like, now, how about, is it also available in a Audible or?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And were you involved in that process at all?
So when the audio, they used to sell the audio rights out, you know, before audio became really ubiquitous. Yeah. And now Penguin Random House does all the audio in-house.
Okay.
So what they do when the book is going to come out is they send me like a selection of audiobook narrators that they think will be a good fit for the book based on, you know, their past experience with these mm-hmm. types of narrators. And I listen to a sample and I say, I like this person the best. And then they try to get them. And that's so far that's worked out.
Well, that's cool. Yeah. Now, do you listen to the audiobooks yourself?
Oh, no, I cannot hear my own work being read. My mom listens to all of them and tells me that they're good.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. All right. So why is it that you don't want to listen to it?
I am not comfortable hearing my own work read by someone else. That would make me very squirmy.
Do you ever go back and reread your old books?
No. By the time the editing process, it's not just developmental edits, which are like the actual story edits, but there's copy edits, which are different. It's a different kind of editing. And then there's proofreading. And then there's, you know, you have to page proof the book, which means when it's typeset, you have to read it to make sure there's no errors in the typesetting. By the time you've gone through all of that, you never want to read your own book ever again. I mean, you've read the book probably like 6 to 10 times.
Okay. So you get to like the page editing, and do you ever find places like, oh my gosh, I wish I could change that?
Sometimes, but not usually. Every once in a while, I'm like, I guess that word sounds weird, but nothing extreme. Okay. You know what I mean? Nothing where I'm like, oh my gosh, I wish I could drastically change the plot of the book. Mm. If I'm thinking about that stuff, it's usually at the developmental edit stage where I'm like, okay, this isn't quite working. You know, I need to fix this, but not by the time I get down to the page proof stage. Truly, by the time I get down to the page proof stage, I'm like, please take this book away from me.
I want to write the next one.
Yeah.
You're listening to Writer's Voices. Our guest today is Christina Henry, author of Where They Buried Your Heart. So let's talk a little bit more about your writing process. You mentioned that you don't know what's going to happen next as you're writing. Are there times where you've gone a certain direction and you realize it's not working and you have to back up?
Not usually. So I write by hand.
Ah.
And when you write by hand, it really slows you down. You're not kind of going off into those kind of blind alleys because you're just typing quickly, you know. I think it's just a much more deliberative process, and I tend not to overwrite. I usually am just trying to get down whatever the scene is, and then a lot of time, every 50 pages or so of handwritten material, I type it into the manuscript, and usually kind of cleaning it up as I go. So if there's any like tweaking and fixing needs to be done, it's usually happening then. And so what's happening is I'm actually editing the book, soft editing the book, mm-hmm. as I'm still writing it. So as I'm going forward, I'm, you know, kind of editing the pages that came before it.
Okay. Are there times where like a new character shows up that you didn't know that this character was going to be here?
Yeah, every once in a while, I'm like, oh, where did you come from? Stuff definitely just pops up. But I don't know that it always sounds a little magical when I'm describing it. But really, I think it's just my subconscious doing a lot of the work for me. And I'm just letting it kind of come forward when it's time.
It really is kind of magical the way our brains work, isn't it?
Yeah.
I have a kind of a skill in pattern recognition, particularly with numbers. And so, and I say it's because of years and years and years working as an accountant and in finance and so forth. But like I can look at a spreadsheet and immediately see where the mistake is, where there's a mistake, mm-hmm. where things don't make sense. And it's like, it's nothing that I'm actually consciously doing.
Right. your brain's just doing it. And how writing is for me.
Yeah.
Like I don't think too deeply about it. I'm always trying to, when I'm asked about my writing process, it's like I'm always trying to like make legible something that's sort of fundamentally illegible. You know what I mean? I'm always like, I don't know, I just write the book.
So So you're writing by hand. Do you have a certain like ritual, like certain type of paper, pen, place, anything like that? Or is it just wherever, whenever?
Yeah, it's kind of wherever, whenever. I prefer to write in the morning. I'm just much more of a morning person. I like to get up early. I go to the gym, or I go out on the lakefront and I do these very long walks. I used to be a marathon runner until I had a very bad injury, but I still can't give up like the distance. So I'll go out and walk like 5 to 8 miles.
Wow.
And then
how long does that take you?
Takes a little while. I mean, it definitely takes longer than when I ran it, I'll tell you.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah.
I used to do 8 miles and be back in an hour and a half, and now it takes longer than that.
Yeah.
But I like that process. I just like to go out and do the walk. And actually, the best day to me is if I have the time, I'll pack a little backpack and put my notebook in the backpack and then like go out and do a really long walk or a hike and just kind of stop along the way and like eat a snack and write some in my notebook. And then maybe like I'll get up and I'll walk some more and stop and write some more, you know. It's really just kind of contemplative for me.
And as you're walking, are you listening on earbuds or are you letting your mind just work on in the
sometimes
back of your mind, work on the book?
Yeah. Sometimes I'm listening to music. Sometimes I listen to like audiobooks of books that I already am familiar with, so that if my brain starts to just space out, I'm not missing anything.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that you're still writing by hand, because there's, you know, I've been doing this show since 2006. And so I've talked to, you know, probably close to 1,000 authors by now. And very few of them are still doing first draft manually. But I love that, because you can do it anywhere.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, the biggest fear is that something will happen to the notebook. There's
no
backup.
Yeah, there's that Hemingway story, right?
Yeah. That's why, like I said, every 50 or so pages, I'm like, I just got to get this in a safe place.
Yeah. Of course, you could photocopy, I guess,
I
every
could,
day.
But... I could, yeah, or scan it.
Yeah. Yeah, we have all this technology now. And I'm not sure that, I mean, I feel like the technology makes writing easier, because I mean, before, if you were somebody who did multiple drafts of something, every draft you have to like start over and type everything all over again, and now you don't have to do that.
Yes.
But does that make our writing better?
I don't know. I mean, I am from the typewriter era. I learned how to type on a typewriter in
Me
high
too.
School. I will say it makes correcting easier. You're not sitting there with the whiteout.
No kidding. So do you, like, how many, after you have the completed manuscript typed in,
mm-hmm.
do you make another pass on it?
Yeah, I do. So I, like I said, I'm kind of cleaning up as I'm going, typing. And then when I'm completely done, I do like one more pass. And what I'm usually looking for, anything obviously that's a plot hole or whatever, but I'm trying to anticipate the questions my editor will ask. So I'm like, oh, will she ask about this? I need to make sure that information is there. And that helps me kind of fill in the draft. And usually by the time I send it to her, I would say it's 97 to 98% done. We don't usually do a ton of edits at that stage, because I've tried really hard to make the manuscript as clean and finished as possible.
Great. Well, Christina, it's, you know, it seems like you've moved more recently more from the fantasy to the horror side of things. Are you going to stay on that side, or what's next for you?
My next book is definitely a horror that should be out later this year. It's called Pin Feathers, and it's about a woman who believes her daughter is turning into a bird. But as for what's ahead, I mean, I have a few different ideas, and you know, I'm always just willing to kind of go wherever my interest takes me. So, you know, maybe there'll be fantasy, maybe there'll be horror, maybe there'll be something else.
Now, have any of your books been series, or are they all standalone?
Yeah, my first book, Black Wings, that became a 7-book series.
Oh, wow.
And then
okay.
Alice, there's 3 books in the Alice series, The Chronicles of Alice.
Do you prefer series or standalone, or you like both?
I prefer standalone. Having written series, I definitely feel like there's a set of expectations that come with series that can make things difficult, because readers start to kind of develop their own ideas of where the story should go. And if you don't do that, they get angry with you.
Yeah, they don't. They definitely don't want you to kill off the love interest, right?
Or whatever. I mean, they get, you know, people kind of start to make their own headcanon for things that are happening. And you have to, I mean, obviously, I'm just going to write wherever I think the story goes. But they're definitely, I think there's more pressure if you're a series writer to fulfill whatever random idea people might have in their head. So I definitely prefer writing standalone. I don't really enjoy the process of series anymore.
Now, are all of your books geared towards adults, or are any of them YA?
Oh no, all my books are for adults.
Yeah.
So even a book like The Place Where They Buried Your Heart, which is, you know, a coming of age story. She starts off at age of 13, but she grows to an adult over the course of the book. That's definitely, this book is 100% intended for adults, as are all my books.
Would you ever want to write YA? Doesn't sound like it.
it's for a different audience. And I think that's really the difference. It's not the age of the character in the book. It's who is your intended audience when you're writing the book. And I have not felt called to write for that audience. I'm writing for adults, but if it came to me, then, you know, maybe I would write that, you know.
Well, Christine, I want to thank you for being with us today. It was a fun conversation, and I enjoyed the book, even though I found it very scary.
And that's the best thing a horror writer can hear, is that I scared you.
And I'm going to close with a quote from Stephen King, who, of course, is the master of 21st century horror writing, who said, "We make up horrors to help us cope with the real ones."
Yeah, definitely accurate.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for having me. This was super fun.
Thank you. And see you all next week on Writer's Voices.